From underneath an arched bridge, the stone towers of a cathedral peer above a tree line. Inside, a vaulted ceiling is supported by pillars.
For almost 1,000 years, Norman cathedrals and castles have dominated the British landscape. But this Norman legacy has eclipsed another culture.
A man with a metal detector.
A golden treasure trove of their art remained buried in the countryside.
Gold jewellery.
The lost art of a people the Normans conquered. The art of the Anglo-Saxons.
The discovery of these golden hoards would radically alter our interpretation of the Anglo-Saxons.
More examples of Anglo-Saxon gold.
They used materials and techniques that brought together the ideas and beliefs of Scandinavia, mainland Europe, and the Middle East.
Intricate serpent-like illustrations.
The Anglo-Saxons developed a complex artistic language which combined both their pagan past and their Christian future.
A rubbing of a young man with his fist in his mouth.
They created a world of codes and messages that revealed the inner workings of the Anglo-Saxon mind, much of which has remained hidden until now.
Treasures of the Anglo-Saxons, presented by Dr. Janina Ramirez, art historian, Oxford University. Janina climbs an enclosed staircase leading up to the entrance of the Ashmolean Museum, Oxford.
Surprisingly, much of the Anglo-Saxon art in British museums was actually discovered less than a century ago. In the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, among its array of priceless artefacts, is one of the most comprehensive collections of Anglo-Saxon gold work.
Display cases contain ornate circular gold artefacts.
When I used to come here as a student, I was mesmerised by the beauty and intricacy of these glittering artworks. The craftsmanship and the detail of each one captivated me.
Tongue-shaped pieces of gold.
Over the years, many archaeologists and historians have studied virtually every aspect of these Anglo-Saxon hoards. But I'm the first art historian to try and take a fresh look at them.
Janina peers into display cases housing delicately carved works of art.
The early Anglo-Saxons were violent warriors who carried with them an amazing wealth of personal art. Jewellery they would wear into battle.
Necklaces and brooches.
When I look at them, it's amazing to think that these are all over 1,000 years old, and each one tells their own story.
A hand dips a fountain pen in an inkwell, then proceeds to draw a map of Northern Europe.
The story of the Anglo-Saxons begins at the start of the 4th century. They were not a single tribe, they were a combination of different tribes. They came from what is now the Netherlands, Northern Germany, and Denmark.
Arrows extend from those locations to the eastern coast of Britain.
Their art is full of symbols and messages that refer to Norse myth and legend, images of Odin with his horned helmet, and other animals like these serpents that slither over the artwork. But by the end of the Anglo-Saxon period, in the 11th century, they had developed one of the most complex visual languages on Earth. This astonishing Dark Age artistic movement was stopped pretty much dead in its tracks by the Normans, and their artistic goals could not have been more different.
Imposing fort-like towers loom large beneath a grey sky. Durham Cathedral, Northumberland.
Northumberland.
One of the first things the Normans did after defeating the Anglo-Saxons in 1066 was to build the mighty Durham Cathedral.
Its form resembles that of a castle.
The architecture is one of occupation. The Normans were all about building permanent public art, unlike the early Anglo-Saxons, whose warrior culture demanded smaller, portable, more personal art.
Janina walks towards the cathedral, entering through an opening in a large wooden door and finding herself in a vast sanctuary.
When the Normans took over, they set about remaking much of Anglo-Saxon culture into their own. However, some remnants of the old Anglo-Saxon world would endure this Norman cultural onslaught.
Janina enters a library with wooden beams supporting the ceiling.
In ancient libraries like this, a few precious Anglo-Saxon stories and poems did survive. And they've enthralled me ever since I was a schoolgirl.
The world of the very early Anglo-Saxons is mainly one of the spoken word. There are virtually no written records. But we catch glimpses of their vivid culture from the poetry and riddles written down by monks in later centuries. For example, the epic poem The Wanderer tells of a warrior far from the life of the hall.
Where is the horse gone? Where is the rider? Where now is the giver of the ring? Where now are the high seats? Where are the revels in the hall? O bright chalice, O chain-mailed warrior, O the dignity of the people. Leather-bound volumes.
Although the Normans brought their own language with them, some words spoken by the Anglo-Saxons still survive today. Mother and father, Monday and Tuesday, he and she, all these words come from the Anglo-Saxons. But aside from these words and poems, there's a lack of written evidence. As a result, the popular conception for centuries was that the Dark Ages were precisely that, dark.
A grinning stone statue.
When it comes to the very early Anglo-Saxon treasures, these only survived because they were buried in the ground long before the Normans came. And we are still finding more of this golden art today.
The biggest haul of Anglo-Saxon gold ever discovered has been found in a field in Staffordshire.
It's absolutely astonishing. I never, ever in my career thought I would be holding this kind of treasure.
The footage of the dig is extraordinary. It just didn't seem to stop.
Unbelievable.
It's the sort of thing you dream of.
This has lain underground for more than 1,300 years.
Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery.
At a cost of some £3.5 million, the Staffordshire hoard has now been bought for the nation.
The man from the news report.
Hello, Dave.
Hello.
Lovely to meet you.
Welcome to Birmingham.
The archaeologist who oversaw the initial find, Dave Simmons, has been busy cataloguing some of the 3,500 pieces found in the hoard. I'm most keen to see the processional cross, which remains bent and twisted from the day it was grabbed by an Anglo-Saxon warrior.
This is actually the largest single piece in the hoard. It's
right.
About 140 grams of gold staring you in the face there.
Gosh, do you think we can have a look at it close up?
We can, yes.
Fantastic.
What we have here is probably a processional cross of some kind.
It's amazing to see it in the flesh like this.
It's a pretty remarkable piece.
If you look at the reconstruction that one of our technicians did, you can see there are actually these three little holes.
Mm.
And that means this thing would have originally been fastened to the top of a pole or something and carried as a processional cross.
Mm.
And probably to make it fit in the hoard, it's been folded up.
Mm.
And I mean, if I turn it over, you can see that the arms have just been folded in on itself. That's actually the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And you can see the three little holes.
Mm.
In the 7th century, this could have been a military weapon. This is your secret weapon. This is bringing your religion into battle on your side.
So I presume you think it's war booty then?
I find it hard to understand how you acquire the bits from 90-plus swords without it being something connected with war.
Yes.
This is warrior bling. This is people wearing really dramatic, really elaborate gold decoration to their swords, to their equipment.
And everything about the way these things are cut and designed is about the effect on the battlefield, isn't it?
Well, the phrase that I particularly like is the idea of the psychopathic peacock. These are the man who will chop you in half with his sword without thinking twice about it, and, you know, because he's that kind of person, he's valued by the king. People have looked at a lot of the things in this hoard and said, surely they're made for parade, they're not for real battle. Mm. Yes, they are. Mm. You're there in that battle looking as magnificent as you can, because that tells everybody how important you are.
Gold artifacts.
The Staffordshire hoard is one of the most significant discoveries of Anglo-Saxon art ever made. It's staggering to think that this is all war booty taken from the bodies of fallen warriors after a battle that ended more than 1,200 years ago.
A curved piece bearing a red serpentine motif.
Looking at the intricate design and beautiful craftsmanship, it's a sobering thought that in order to see this detail clearly, you'd have to get very close indeed to the man wearing it. And it would probably be the last thing you ever saw, given their fearsome reputation for chopping people up. But why did these beautifully jeweled pagan warriors come to Britain in the first place?
Janina walks alongside a wall lining a busy high street.
The simple answer is there were no Roman soldiers here to stop them.
The Romans quite like building walls. In fact, they built one right across the entire country to stop the barbaric Picts and Scots from attacking Roman Britain. And they did a pretty good job of keeping out not just the Picts and Scots, but also barbaric invaders from Northern Europe, the ancestors of the Anglo-Saxons.
She continues walking, now a narrow waterway flanked with grassy banks.
By the start of the 4th century, the Roman Empire was in decline. And the provinces first to go would be the ones furthest from Rome. In 410, the Emperor Honorius wrote to the local authorities in Britain with the news they must have been dreading. Rome would no longer be able to send reinforcements to help defend them against barbarian attacks. The British monk Gildas, writing some 150 years after this event, imaginatively described it as the groan of the Britons. According to Gildas, initially 3 boatloads of Saxon warriors arrived to defend against the Picts in the north. They might have been mercenaries invited over by Vortigern, a legendary ancient British warlord.
A beached fishing boat.
However, they soon rebelled, and as more of their fellow tribesmen arrived, they began to take over. We've no way of knowing how much of this is true. The Romano-British certainly defended themselves, but the Anglo-Saxons were here to stay.
The word Saxon forms part of the boat's name, emblazoned on a banner secured to its deck. Janina walks through a village, passing a sign which reads, "The Caravan Club."
By the 5th century, the Anglo-Saxons had taken over most of the eastern half of England.
Janina stands at the village limits.
This is Fingalsham in Kent, and here on the village sign you can see a little figure, Odin, the Norse god, a central character in all the early Anglo-Saxon pagan beliefs. And they've put him on the village sign not because the inhabitants are pagan, well, they might be, but because near here an archaeological dig unearthed a golden belt buckle with a depiction of Odin. It's now known as the Fingalsham Buckle, and it's one of the most famous Anglo-Saxon artworks found in Kent.
Sweeping fields of yellow and green.
The Fingalsham Buckle was unearthed in 1934 on the Northbourne estate. At the time, Lord Northbourne was a small boy. He remembers the discovery of an Anglo-Saxon grave that aroused the interest of some local archaeologists.
If you look at this mess out here, which was a chalk quarry, somebody noticed that there was obviously a grave in it. And Mr. Stebbing, who was mayor of Sandwich, and a friend of his who was also an archaeologist, came out here, had a look at it. And then they decided that it must be something interesting behind this, and they excavated about the first 10 or 15 graves, I think, up here.
So these lovely finds that were coming out of your land ended up in your possession?
That was the law in those days, you know. And actually what happened was about half of them went to local museums, and about the other half my father retained.
Mm. The family still have the treasures, and Lord Northbourne took me to his son's house to see them.
This is my son Charles.
Hi, lovely to meet you, Charles.
Thank you. Hello.
I understand you're going to show me the treasures.
I have the treasures here.
Wonderful.
Oh, my goodness. So I'm going to show you the buckle here. This is the famous Fingolfin buckle, which I'll put down for you here.
Oh, my gosh. My goodness. Can I pick it up and have a look?
Absolutely.
Wow. It's a solid piece of metal, isn't it? So it's gilded with a silver backplate. I mean, everything about it, it's so golden and bright. It would have looked so amazing on a military attire. If we have a look at the figure, well, we know it's Odin, of course, because of this teardrop-shaped head and these hook-beaked birds coming out from the prow of the helmet. And then he's wearing his own version of the buckle around his middle. Very excited. Sorry, I'm getting a bit hot and excited at this. It's interesting, of course, that he's naked, because this was one of the things that set apart the early so-called barbarian warriors, that they would run into battle naked, wielding their weapons. I get an overwhelming sense of excitement holding such an amazing piece of art like this. It is a national treasure. It's something hugely important to our art history.
Janina examines the rest of the pieces, which include an item shaped like a bird with a hooked beak.
All these finds from Fingolfin really give us a vivid picture of 5th century Anglo-Saxon England. These are Germanic pieces, pagan pieces. They're full of imagery that's coming out of the pagan belief system. Birds, Odin with his spears.
A smouldering log fire dissolves into a line drawing of a man with a long beard, sitting on a throne, with ravens by his head and dogs at his feet.
So what do we know about Odin and the pagan beliefs of the Anglo-Saxons? Well, Odin was the chief god in Norse mythology, ruler of Asgard, the location of Valhalla, which was the great hall where dead warriors believed they would go to in the afterlife to feast and drink for all eternity.
A raven perched on a man's shoulder.
Snakes, boars, bears, wolves, and ravens, all these animals appear in Anglo-Saxon art, and each is tied to a specific Norse legend. Warriors believed they could transform into these animals. And it was these pagan beliefs that fostered the idea that the Anglo-Saxons were primitive.
A modest dwelling with a thatched roof.
For a long time, historians thought that very early Anglo-Saxon kings were barbarians, not nearly as sophisticated as the Christian Romano-Britons they had conquered. And the archaeological evidence seemed to support this, suggesting that they lived in simple wooden structures like this hovel. However, the truth was very different, and it was not until Britain was again faced with another Germanic invasion that an archaeological discovery was made that would transform our understanding of the Anglo-Saxon world forever.
Summer 1939. Grainy archive footage shows an archaeological dig.
In 1939, as Britain prepared for war, a team of archaeologists were preparing to excavate an Anglo-Saxon burial site at Sutton Hoo in East Anglia. What they found astonished them. It was a longboat, 18 metres from stem to stern, and inside it was full of precious artefacts, the like of which no one had seen before. There was so much treasure, a man with this wealth could not have lived in a hovel. The archaeologist concluded that this had to be the grave of a king.
Altogether, this is easily the most magnificent collection of Saxon jewellery ever found. Probably the finest piece artistically is the great gold buckle, over 14 ounces of solid gold. Sliding latches on the back plate allow it to open and show how it was attached to the leather belt.
The buckle is opened to reveal a hinge at one end. Janina climbs a wide staircase at the British Museum, London.
Today, the Sutton Hoo treasures have pride of place in the British Museum's Anglo-Saxon collection. The finds from Sutton Hoo would literally rewrite the history books.
Janina examines gold pieces mounted on a wall.
If you look at some of the details, it's clear these objects are coming straight out of Scandinavia. Here is the raven of Odin, the beast of battle, its beak curling round. And these amazing long claws curving in on themselves. This is Odin's bird, ready to crawl over the bodies of the deceased on the battlefield. And the helmet, very Scandinavian. It must have made quite an impression on the battlefield. Here, coming up the front, we have two dragons, big snarling teeth meeting in the middle and protecting the crown. And then over the eyebrows, two boars, their eyes picked out in glistening garnets. Boars were very potent symbols to Anglo-Saxon warriors. Let me explain why.
Janina has a pint at a pub called the Boar's Head Inn.
In the pagan beliefs of the early Anglo-Saxons, the boar symbolised fertility. The goddess Freya rode one called Hildisvanir into battle, that is, when she wasn't riding her cat-drawn chariot. This was one of the few times in history when saying someone is a boar in bed was actually a compliment.
Janina steps in front of an enlarged projected image of a piece of jewellery bearing intertwining snake-like markings.
But birds and boars weren't the only animal symbols depicted on the Sutton Hoo treasures. There are also snakes, lots of snakes. You can see them writhing over the surface here of the great golden belt buckle. Here, two intertwine around one another in this beautiful interlaced pattern. But why the fascination with snakes?
A live specimen coils itself around Janina's wrist.
The snakes are, in fact, Jormungandr, or the world serpent from Norse mythology. Legend has it that he was the son of another god that Odin tossed into the sea, where he grew into a serpent. A serpent large enough to surround the entire world and grab his own tail. It was literally the worm that turned the world. And the Anglo-Saxons believed that if the snake or worm ever let go of its tail, then the world would end.
The small serpent extends its forked tongue. Now Janina's examining a blow-up of a pair of ornate clasps.
This is my absolute favourite piece, the Sutton Hoo shoulder clasps. And you can see that serpents writhe all over it. They interlace down the sides here, along the bottom, and winding up here in this intricate pattern.
Close-up views reveal the intricacy of the snake motif.
And then there are the boars. There's two of them at each end of the shoulder clasp. They're quite difficult to make out. If I isolate just one, you can see the snout with the tusk here, and you follow the shape of the head up to the ear and round below the face, and the spine coming all the way down here, and then the little trotter at the back.
The boar shapes blend into the clasp's overall design.
These pieces show us just how sophisticated and international the Anglo-Saxons were. Glass from Italy, garnet from India, and these delicate checkerboard patterns. Some of them are only a millimetre wide. It's amazing craftsmanship, and something only a few elite jewellers could reproduce today.
Janina crosses a street and enters the plush premises of a jeweller's, Garrod, London.
Garrods are one of the most famous jewellers in the world. The craftsmen here create some of the most exclusive jewellery money can buy.
A bejewelled pendant and earrings.
With pieces ranging upwards of a quarter of a million pounds, their jewellery adorns billionaires, pop stars and royalty.
A computer screen.
The way we're looking at it there, and then we see the side.
Designer Stephen Webster, the man in charge, believes the techniques the Anglo-Saxon smiths used to make the shoulder clasps are the same ones still in use today.
A workshop.
This is where the kind of the jewellery manufacturing process has really not moved on the way that you might have thought over 1600 years or 1500 years or something. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of small hand tools, and even though they would have been cruder, these are very, very similar.
Yeah.
So we've got a ring here that's for a customer in Las Vegas. So the best way to go about that is to carve this in wax.
Right.
So this is the first technique that's the same, you know? So he's carving in wax. And do you want to just show us some of the tools that you use for the carving?
Yeah, I'm just using sculpers and a scraper.
So these are just sharp steel tools.
Again, they don't look like particularly modern pieces, do they?
There's nothing modern on his bench, not even his lunch.
To make the hundreds of garnet inserts, the Anglo-Saxons would have glued them to sticks like this and cut them to size on a grinding stone.
The jeweller demonstrates on an electric wheel.
I couldn't resist the opportunity to have a go myself.
Oh, my God.
Nervous.
I'm really nervous.
Thing to do is to hold it firm, but go in and feel it so you feel it bite. All right, that's it. And then you just keep it like that.
Oh, wow, OK. Wow. Oh, it's good. I can see it's wearing down. We have liftoff. Oh. Wow.
Well, anyway, you get the gist of it. The rest is just time.
Well, I've certainly worn a little bit down, but that must take ages to cut that whole shape
out.
Well,
it kind of gives you an idea, doesn't it? We've got a modern tool.
Yeah.
We've got electricity. So they're just going to sit there and work it with whatever they had.
But it really puts it into perspective. And, you know, a minute of doing that and it's barely scratched the gem. And yet they'd have had to have done that over and over down to... Have I done it well?
Got a facet on it. You did it well. Yeah.
Fantastic. So I guess the million-dollar question is, to make that pair of Sutton Hoo shoulder clasps, how much are we talking?
We think it would be just shy of £200,000.
Right. And it would take how long, do you think?
Well, we figured on something close to 4 weeks each.
Wow.
You know, there's not that many shortcuts. Mm. We've just got better tools and, you know, better things available, but it's still a lot of handwork.
Yeah. So 200 grand in 2 months, and you could just about end up with a pair of shoulder clasps.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Speeded up footage of clouds scudding across a blue sky.
To the Anglo-Saxons, the smiths who created their jewellery must have seemed like magicians. In fact, they even made one smith a god. And his story is an epic tale of enchanting jewels, rape, and murder.
the ancient ruins of a stone structure set in a woodland clearing, Wayland Smithy, Oxfordshire.
The tale of Welland is one of my favourite Norse legends. Welland the Smith was a happily married man who made fantastic swords and jewellery. One night, in his sleep, he was captured by the cruel King Nithard.
A tall tree with a twisted trunk.
The king imprisoned Welland on an island and forced him to make jewellery for him. To make sure he couldn't escape, the king ordered him to be hamstrung.
Barbed wire.
Crippled, knowing he wouldn't see his wife again, Welland exacted a terrible revenge. He murdered the king's sons, fashioned goblets from their skulls, jewels from their eyes, and a brooch from their teeth. Welland then took back his wedding ring from the king's daughter before raping her, fathering a son, and escaping on a pair of wings he'd made earlier.
A bird in silhouette takes flight from a branch of a leafless tree.
A truly grim fairy tale, but one that might actually contain a grain of truth. Many of the Anglo-Saxon Smiths may well have been slaves like Welland. The gold and treasures found at Sutton Hoo had made historians question if Anglo-Saxon kings really had lived in small wooden hovels.
It couldn't have been in places like this.
An elderly man with a long grey beard, dressed in Anglo-Saxon attire.
After the Second World War, archaeologists discovered evidence that Anglo-Saxon kings lived in giant wooden palaces.
We now think that Anglo-Saxon kings lived in huge halls like this replica in Kent. Digs at Yavering in Northumbria unearthed a hall twice the size of this one, with an auditorium that seated over 300 people.
Inside the spacious half-timber hall, smoke from a fire set in a patch of earth rises towards the rafters.
These halls feature in Old English poems like the epic Beowulf, which for me gives the most evocative idea of life in the hall. Indeed, the poem opens with the command, "What? Listen," which you can imagine being shouted across a crowded hall of drunken warriors. Him on Mod Bayan.
It came into his mind to ask his loyal men to set up a hall, a master mead house, mightier far than ever was seen by the sons of earth. And within it then, to add old and young, he would allot all that the Lord had sent him. The man in Anglo-Saxon attire sharpens a stick.
This replica hall was built by the Regia Anglorum Society. The 700 members devote their weekends to recreating Anglo-Saxon life in Kent.
We wanted somewhere where we could do practical archaeology and to recreate things which we know exist in the archaeological record in the environment in which they had been originally used.
So it's like living research.
Yeah, that's right. It is somewhere where we can trace the footprints of our ancestors. Mm. And we feel very strongly that if we can trace their footprints in time, we can see what they saw.
So you think the interior of these halls would have been brightly decorated and coloured?
Very much so. We know that our Anglo-Saxon ancestors enjoyed bright colours because they lived in a fairly drab world. Mm. The apex of our porch has some very pretty colours on there.
Yes, because it's a very bright use of blues and reds and golds.
Absolutely.
And very regal as well, the palette of colours.
Yeah, yeah, you might even say it looked like a Chinese restaurant.
A ship crosses in front of a rose-pink sky.
In 597, a man came across the sea with an idea that would transform the art of the Anglo-Saxons. Saint Augustine was on a mission from God and Pope Gregory.
He stepped off his boat right here, well, just over there, close to what's now Saint Augustine's golf course.
Janina walks along a country lane, passing a sign reading, St. Augustine's Golf Club. Then a man has a putt on a green.
Led Legend has it that Pope Gregory's decision to convert the pagan Anglo-Saxons came about thanks to a papal pun. On seeing some Angles in a Roman slave market, he asked, "Where are they from?" Hearing that they are Angles, he said, "They are not Angles, but angels."
So the Pope decided the Angle angels were so beautiful they had to be Christian.
He dispatched St. Augustine to ensure that all of the British Isles would now follow him and God, not Odin and lots of pagan gods.
So what was life like in these newly converted kingdoms?
Well, it was quite nice, actually.
Now Janina's pushing a small child in a buggy along a pavement.
According to Bede, a monk writing some time later, in Edwin's Northumbria, it was completely safe for a woman and child to walk from one end of his lands to the other. And when times were tough and peasants turned up at Edwin's great hall in search of food, he not only gave them his dinner, but the silver plate it was on too. What a nice man.
The child's eating cake.
It sounds like a peaceful time. It wasn't always quite like that, but it was a time when pagan and Christian beliefs did coexist, and this was reflected in the art.
Here, in the British Museum, is one of the best examples that shows how readily the Anglo-Saxons were prepared to follow both Christ and Odin.
A triangular decorative buckle bears the Anglo-Saxon interlacing snake design along its edges.
This is one of my favourite pieces, the silver and gilt belt buckle from Crundale in Kent. This is a serious piece of double-edged art, literally. Look at how these symbols sit alongside each other. Knotted pagan snakes and a Christian fish. This piece clearly shows it was made at a time when the Anglo-Saxons were hedging their bets, embracing Christianity and keeping hold of their pagan heritage. Looking at it now, you can imagine the sort of man who commissioned it. One week, he's fasting for Easter. The next, he's feasting for the goddess Aostra.
Janina walks towards an antiques shop.
For about a century, the Anglo-Saxons continued to flip between paganism and Christianity. And sometime in the 7th century, one stunning piece of art was created that perfectly encapsulated this eclectic view of the world.
Inside the shop.
In 1857, the avid Victorian collector Sir Augustus Wollaston Franks was on a shopping trip to Paris in pursuit of his favourite pastime, buying antiques. He heard about a rather unusual item a dealer had for sale. It had lay hidden for nearly 1,000 years. And eventually, it wound up in a Parisian antique shop. When Wollaston Franks saw it, he couldn't resist.
A slightly damaged box with scenes carved into its exterior.
Today, it's known as the Franks casket. Carved out of whalebone, it's an amazing visual representation of the early Anglo-Saxons' view of the history of the world. It's well over 1,200 years old now, and it has to be kept in a climate-controlled case. It's far too delicate to be handled.
So the British Museum had this replica made, which I can hold. And this means I can show you that the Franks casket is a truly three-dimensional art object. It's like an Anglo-Saxon Rubik's Cube. But if we start at the front, where the key would enter the lock that's now missing, we've got two very enigmatic scenes. Here to the left, we've got the legendary Germanic story of Welland the Smith. Welland has killed the king's son and is offering a drugged goblet made from his skull to the daughter. And to the side of this,
three figures, the three magi, approaching two figures here. Mary and Jesus have been abbreviated to teardrop-shaped heads. A scene from Germanic myth alongside a Christian image. But if we turn it around to the left, something else enters the equation. A scene from Roman legend. Here we've got a very unusual version of Romulus and Remus being nursed by the wolf. Typically, they're shown as children underneath the wolf, but the Anglo-Saxons have shown them as full-grown adults lying out prostrate on the ground. With this upside-down wolf here. But I love this object because it captures that moment when the Anglo-Saxons are moving from paganism to Christianity. And in this one piece, we've got so many of the legends and so much of the imagery that had previously dominated Anglo-Saxon art.
Speeded up footage of a morning sun rising above a distant mountain range. Janina stares thoughtfully into the distance, now a stone church.
A century after St. Augustine had landed, stone symbols of the Christian faith began to dominate the British landscape.
A graveyard dominated by crosses.
In the wooden world of the Anglo-Saxons, stone crosses made a big impact.
This proved to be an effective advertising campaign, one that definitely said paganism was fading away and Christianity was here to stay.
Clouds drifting across the sky above the church.
New churches and abbeys sprung up throughout the Anglo-Saxon lands.
St. Paul's Church, Jarrow.
In 674, Abbot Benedict Biscop founded a monastery here. Now, very few Anglo-Saxon buildings survive, but inside, the entire chancel is original.
As Janina enters the building, a sign invites visitors to donate £1 to the church.
In its day, this place was an island of Mediterranean culture in a sea of barbarism.
She makes her way through the church.
The abbot, Biscop, was a well-travelled man. In his lifetime, he made many trips to Rome, and I think he fell in love with the place.
She walks towards the altar.
So much so that he decided to create a little bit of Rome here in the northeast of England.
Elaborate crosses.
The chancery he built is now one of the oldest buildings in Britain. But working in stone wasn't the only idea Biscop brought back from his travels.
Biscop introduced another new concept, one the Anglo-Saxons had never seen before, and one that we couldn't live without today. Glazed windows. This is it, one of the earliest stained glass windows in Britain.
A small circular window.
But Jarrow wasn't to be remembered for its stonework and glass. There was another art form that it was to become world famous for. Manuscripts.
Numbered volumes, each bearing a year from the 19th century.
Although the whole country was now Christian, the church was effectively split in two. On the one side were the newly converted Anglo-Saxons in England. On the other were the Celtic churches in the rest of the country. The easiest way to understand their artistic and spiritual differences is to look at how they both drew people.
This is the Macdernan Gospel. It's typical of the style of manuscript produced by the very early Christians in the Celtic parts of Britain and Ireland. It's small because it was designed to be carried by the clergymen as they travelled around the land preaching.
The depiction of the figure is very stylized. It's almost a cartoon.
If you look at the feet, they're cloven, not at all realistic.
Some scholars have speculated it comes from a belief that only God can create a true image of man. The Anglo-Saxons, who took their ideas directly from St. Augustine and Rome, had no problem drawing man and his feet naturalistically. This is the Durham Cassiodorus. It's a fantastic Anglo-Saxon manuscript. Take a look at the figure here. It's far more naturalistic and realistic. And the treatment of the feet, no cloven hooves here. The artist has even included tiny little toenails. It's far more in keeping with the classical tradition of art that's coming out of Rome. The Celtic and Anglo-Saxon Christians couldn't even agree when to celebrate Easter. And although these different approaches to drawing feet may seem trivial to us now, at the time they represented a real fundamental difference between the two Christian camps. These two artistic styles may seem irreconcilable, but the life of one man was to inspire an artwork that would bring the two together.
A long line of posts stuck in sand.
His name was St. Cuthbert, and he spent most of his life on the holy island of Lindisfarne.
A pebble beach at Lindisfarne, Northumberland.
St. Cuthbert was one of Lindisfarne's earliest bishops. The most remarkable thing about Cuthbert was he was all things to all men. He was a nobleman, a hermit, a monk, and a bishop. And in death, he was to become one of the Anglo-Saxons' most treasured saints.
The stone ruins of an ancient church.
In 687, Cuthbert died and was buried here. 11 years later, the monks of Lindisfarne opened his coffin and made an amazing discovery. Cuthbert didn't rot. Because of this, he was declared a saint and a cult would grow up around him.
A solitary cross standing on an island.
In death, Cuthbert managed one final miraculous act, and it would reconcile the artistic differences between the Anglo-Saxon and Celtic churches. He inspired another bishop of Lindisfarne, Eadfrith, to create a manuscript of such beauty it would become one of the pinnacles of Anglo-Saxon artistic achievement. This is it. This is the Lindisfarne Gospels, the finest piece of art from the Dark Ages and a national treasure. Well, this isn't actually it. The original's in the British Library. But this one manuscript is the culmination of centuries of Anglo-Saxon artistic endeavour. And not only that, it manages to resolve the stylistic differences of the two Christian factions.
A carpet page combines numerous bold colours with the familiar intertwining serpentine design.
Let's look at it in a little more detail. Here we have an image of Matthew the Evangelist writing in his Gospel book. And if you look at details like the feet, you can see the same sort of imagery that we saw in the Durham Cassiodorus. That naturalistic treatment of the figure that's coming directly from Rome with St. Augustine.
Matthew sitting barefoot and wearing green and red robes with his gospel on his lap.
And alongside this, we get these full-page illuminations called carpet pages, where the swirls move the eye from image into text. But look at this carpet page in detail. Here we've got Celtic walls and spirals, just like we saw in the McDernan Gospels, here in the borders. They knot along the edges here. And then we've also got Anglo-Saxon animal interlace, just like we saw on the Sutton Hoo belt buckle, where the serpents and beasts wound into one another.
Enlarged images of the carpet page and the belt buckle are projected beside one another for comparison.
And if you look at this carpet page, it's the same imagery that we've seen on the Sutton Hoo shoulder clasps. Look at the centre.
the exact same geometric patterning. It's no accident that they're called carpet pages. They certainly resemble Islamic prayer rugs, and it's possible that Eadfrith had actually seen a Middle Eastern carpet. He certainly had an encyclopedic knowledge of Celtic, Anglo-Saxon, and Christian art of Rome. Today, the Lindisfarne Gospels are considered one of the world's greatest artworks, but less than a century after they were made, they were nearly destroyed by a new wave of violent, bloodthirsty pagan invaders.
Lindisfarne Castle appears through the haze of a burning fire.
In 793, the Vikings sacked Lindisfarne, slaughtering their monks and plundering their treasures.
A sandy-coloured dog sitting quietly on a road, then the crimson hull of a fishing boat quiver in the fire's haze.
By 871, nearly all the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms had been defeated and ravaged by the marauding Vikings.
A bronze statue of a bearded king holding aloft a sword.
Only the newly crowned King of Wessex stood against them.
His name was Alfred, Alfred the Great, and Winchester was his capital city.
A river flowing through a picturesque town.
Under Alfred, Winchester became the very model of Anglo-Saxon civilization, a place where art and culture would flourish.
Janina walks underneath an archway.
During his reign, Alfred introduced many concepts we take for granted today, like taxes, to pay for the defence of his cities.
She walks past a large red brick house.
However, he would never decisively defeat the Vikings, but he did stop them from conquering England completely.
A Norman Gothic cathedral.
Winchester Cathedral was built by the people that did ultimately conquer Anglo-Saxon England, the Normans. But beneath it lies the remains of a great Anglo-Saxon cathedral.
Glimpses of religious figures carved into the walls, an arched stained glass window, a faded angel on a vaulted ceiling. Janina explores the cathedral's spacious interiors.
During his 28 years on the throne, Alfred made the building of new churches and monasteries a priority.
A carved stone figure kneeling in prayer.
The church and his faith were very important to Alfred. He believed the reason that the Vikings had come to rape and pillage his land was simple. His people were not pious enough.
To atone for this lack of piety, Alfred made the production of art dedicated to the glory of God his mission.
And this is his legacy. It became known as the Winchester School, and it shows how the artistry and creativity of the Anglo-Saxons developed in later centuries.
A winged figure points at a man's face peering out of a window.
There's still loads of Anglo-Saxon motifs here. The bold use of colour, gold, this interlacing knotwork here. And as we move on to later works, you see even more naturalism and movement in pieces like this.
A figure on horseback is lauded by followers and onlookers alike.
Look at the treatment of the figure and the drapery here.
Janina picks up another illustration.
And then there's an increasing freedom of expression in pieces like this, where the characters are filling the space and pouring out across the illumination. And looking at this, you can really see why Anglo-Saxon manuscripts became such highly prized artworks throughout Europe.
flame-haired characters gaze up at the hand of God reaching down towards them. Janina walks between display cases.
The freedom and expressiveness of the late Anglo-Saxon period was not limited to manuscripts. There was one piece of jewellery that, when it was found, looked so fresh and was in such good condition, the British Museum thought it was fake.
A large central disc surrounded by several smaller ones.
Of all the works produced in the late Anglo-Saxon period, for me, this, the Fuller Brooch, represents most clearly both where Anglo-Saxon art has come from and where it's heading to.
A rubbing shows its carvings in greater detail.
It's personal, it's portable and shiny, just like the other early Anglo-Saxon warrior bling. But the animals and pagan symbols have now virtually gone. It represents the five senses and the four stages of life around the edge. The most important thing is the treatment of the figures. You can see that there's very little naturalism. Take a look at this central character. The eyes are so enlarged, and the face has been reduced just to the basic features. Then you have these figures around the side. Their bodies are elongated, their gowns are turned into abstract patterns, and they're surrounded by these shapes and arrows. All of this treatment of figural depiction was to disappear for another 1,000 years. That is, until Picasso.
Janina visits the Bayeux Tapestry.
But of course, the Anglo-Saxons never did get as far as Picasso. The Bayeux Tapestry tells the story of their defeat.
Warriors on horseback.
At the Battle of Hastings, the Anglo-Saxons were the losers. And history, even art history, is always written by the winners.
After their victory in 1066, this is one of the first works of art the Normans commissioned. For me, the Bayeux Tapestry lacks the sort of imagination and artistic freedom that made the Anglo-Saxons so special.
As I look at this replica now, how it follows step by step the story of the Norman victory, I can't help but wonder how different the story of Anglo-Saxon art would have been were they not defeated and so many of their treasures lost.
King Harold with an arrow in his eye.
But maybe this is one of the beauties of Anglo-Saxon art. The fact that so much of it was buried for 1,000 years in the British countryside means that today we can see it with truly fresh eyes. And with every new discovery, our understanding of the Anglo-Saxons will keep changing and shine a new light on the Dark Ages.
The man with the metal detector continues his search for treasure.